Welcome to the Garrison Mammal Podcast. This is Chris, and this is two interviews in this episode. Two interviews I did with Sean Sukta from Pepper Data and Robert Reeves from Datacle, kind of loosely around the future of big data, how we're going to be deploying big data applications and building them and orchestrating them in the future. So sort of predictions for the big data world. I hope you enjoy, and I'll speak to you next time.
Well, my name is Robert Reeves. I'm the CTO and one of the co-founders at Datacle. And what we do is we automate those changes to your databases that are needed for application deployment. So instead of creating a ticket and send that to a DBA, we're able to automate that process so that the same way that you deploy your application code, you can also deploy your database code.
And I mean, this is a process that I remember with great pain. I used to work a lot with CMSs and CRMs that would put a lot of configuration in MySQL mostly. And then we had all sorts of weird and wonderful ways to attempt to do what you just described, which never really worked, to be fair. So there was always some kind of problem. And if you thought solving a conflict in Git was hard, solving a conflict in some random config file was even harder. And then various sort of solutions to this came along. I suppose things like Ruby with fixtures and more modern versions of some of the CMSs that I worked with did similar things. But so maybe just explain a little bit behind the scenes without giving away your secret sauce. And now I know you're in Austin, I guess you get secret barbecue sauce of what you're actually doing behind the scenes. Are you abstracting something similar into like a sort of Ruby and Rails styles fixtures, or doing something cleverer? And does that also mean you could include is it just including changes to the structure, or can you make these changes to live systems around actual data that's stored as well?
Well, that's, you know, it's great that you bring up Ruby on Rails, because that is where the genesis of the idea came from. When, you know, Ruby on Rails came out, that was amazing stuff. The idea that I could write code and my database schema would be migrated automatically. I add a new attribute to an object. Well, that typically means a new column in a table. And Ruby on Rails would take care of that. The only problem was you had to use Ruby on Rails. And that, in a Java world, that's not going to happen. And so Nathan Voxland, who is our architect at Datacle, was looking at this problem and said, hey, I really like that, and I want that for Java. And his approach was to create an object model. You know, when you look at SQL, there are bits of information in there. There are things like table names and columns and data types and stuff. But the syntax, it doesn't change. There's only one way to alter a table and add a column. All right. There's subtle variations, but on each platform, Oracle, MySQL, you name it, it has a set way of doing that. So what he did was put the data in an XML document. And from there, you know, look at the database and say, okay, what version are you? And you are... database says I'm version 22. Well, we need to get you to 24. So we're going to apply changes 23 and 24. Great. I'm version 16. Well, we got to run a few more. And so what that allowed us to do was to migrate the database, to evolve it. But it allowed us to go a step further. So what we can do now, because of that object model, is Datacle can do a forecast, show you what's going to change, but don't change it. You get a nice HTML report. And then we can also do rules. So things like, you might have a corporate standard that says all tables must start with T underscore. Cool. We can enforce that. But we can also go even further. And you might have a rule that says all foreign keys, the columns that make up a foreign key must have a index applied to them. That's just, you know, DBA 101. But sometimes you forget. And so we make certain that if a rule, a standard is violated, it actually breaks the build.
Yes, so for sure. Yeah.
You don't have a DBA looking over a developer's shoulder. The developer, you know, will actually break the build because they violated a standard, like breaking a unit test. And, you know, there's two ways to get a developer to focus on something, you know, to get them out of their seat and move in. One is there's food in the break room, and two, you broke the build, an email that says that. That's how you get them to work.
And a big red light goes off. Yes.
Yeah. It's sirens.
So, you know? And this process that you described with Datacle takes into consideration production or staging or whatever you define data, or is it still kind of around the more the skeleton of an application?
It, very much the schema. We don't focus on the data. We certainly can do that. So a lot of applications have metadata. So they might in the database store the location of the email server to send notices. All right. So the SMTP server might be different from dev, QA, and production. You might have a different Google Maps API key.
Exactly.
And you store that in the database. All right. So we can manage that. No problem. And so, and say, all right, in dev, it's different from test, it's different from prod. But we really focus on that schema migration. That is seems to be the biggest blocker for large companies right now. They have what I call macro services architecture. These large monolithic apps that all talk to each other and they're all dependent. And they got a lot of problems with updating. And they're just throwing bodies at the problem right now. And frankly, that is just killing our DBAs and frustrating our developers. It's just not working.
So you created your own buzzword there, but just to sort of throw in the one that I think you were spoofing. So is this with an effort to try and encourage and push some of these sorts of companies and teams into something that's more microservices based in the long run? You know, this thinking about this separation of concerns. I mean, can you change with them and change the way that they use Datacle with them if they do become more separated from each other?
Every company that uses Datacle wants or is planning on moving to microservices. Yeah. The companies that are not are going to go the way of Sears and Kmart. It's if you look, Mark Andreessen said it, not me. He said software will eat the world. And it follows that, you know, the companies that make the best software, that have better engagement with their customers, are going to succeed. The ones that write crappy software are going to fail. And so right now there's this decades of legacy app infrastructure that companies are trying to either leverage or get rid of, but they can't because like 95% of their revenue goes through these apps. So what can they do to speed improvements to these apps while they're working on that new, that replatforming? How do they improve the plane as it's taxing down the runway? And for a lot of these companies, struggling with this policy that we must engage a DBA to manually review a SQL script, that's just not working.
So you talked a little bit about the workflow that DBAs and developers, when they're trying to make changes, go through. Just describe that a little bit to me, a little bit more to me. So I guess either, well, who would make the first change, or is the answer to that anybody?
Well, what we suggest, and that's in all caps, suggest, is we challenge our customers to adopt decentralized data management. Sure. We need to have the development team in charge of authoring these changes. Yep. We call them change sets. And DBAs need to move into a more senatorial role, like advising consent on you know, nominees. You know, that's where they succeed, where they will do more, will provide more value for the company. Instead of being a gate to go through, they need to be coaching and helping developers understand why these rules are in place. Instead of enforcing them, instead of being a line judge, they need to be a coach. And also, they get to do other cool things. Like, you know, companies that have adopted Datacle and no longer have DBAs involved in the actual push of the change are able to do things like tackle that cloud migration for their databases. They're able to figure out exactly. Or how do we shard off this monolithic database into component databases, smaller pieces that align with the microservices? That's where we need our skilled data professionals at, not handling tickets like they're running a help desk. That's just rude.
And or maybe I can give you a new slogan to use. Instead of database administrators, they become database ambassadors.
Oh, yes.
So, I don't know. From the developer side, I mean, on your product page, especially the database code packager, you use a lot of terms that developers will be familiar with from version control of code. Mm-hmm. How similar does this process look to something like GitHub or GitLab or SVN, if they're still there, or Mercurial, you know, those sorts of systems, and they're used to seeing merge requests and pull requests and how they look like a diff. How similar is this? I guess how similar is the process to developers, and or how much does it fit into their kind of existing workflows?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, we don't provide a source code control system. Sure. I think it's a bad move for any company to say, oh, I have this tool and you have to use my walled garden version control system. That's not cool. What we do is we leverage Git, Subversion, whatever source code control system you want to use. All right, doesn't matter. On-prem, hosted, we don't care. All we want to see is our developers that are using Datacle just check in the SQL script.
Okay.
Just check it in. You're adding a column. You know, there's certainly ways we can help create those scripts for you. But at the end of the day, you are going to check in a SQL script, and Datacle will create an immutable artifact that can move from one environment to the next, just like your compiled Java code or .NET or whatever you're creating. With your application, your compiled code, you're creating some kind of artifact. Well, we create a database artifact that you can deploy on any environment and it will catch it up. Is it a database that hasn't been touched in a few months? We'll catch it up. Is it a brand new Amazon RDS instance? Sure. We'll roll out the latest and greatest schema on there, and also schema, and also put the metadata necessary for that app to run. It all starts with the developers prescriptively saying, I want you to make this change. And we take it from there.
This can sit on top of existing version control systems, or?
Absolutely. It is just the height of arrogance to go into somebody's house and start rearranging the furniture. You know, when we are invited into somebody's house, into somebody's business, it is imperative that we work with what they have today. So we work with any source code control system. We work with any application release automation stuff they have. Like, you name it, we'll work with it.
Okay. But then the your magic is then in your system, I guess. So it feeds off of these existing systems, but then to offer the Datacle magic, they then have to go to an additional dashboard or whatever, which is not a huge problem. But, you know,
just in a browser. Yeah. We can also a lot of our customers that might use like ARA, like Zevia Labs. Okay. they will not really see Datacle. They'll see a step that says, you know, deploy the database, and that's Datacle there, but they don't care. It's just happening. It's like, you know, what Asimov said, you know, what was sufficiently advanced technology looks like magic at some point. And that's what we do. We just make it happen so people can move on and focus on tasks that really move the business forward, not updating a database. It's nobody's going to buy something from a company and say, wow, they're really good at managing their database.
Not anymore. Maybe in the past, but yeah. So you were interested in scheduling this call. I mean, we've already talked about some things that to some people probably already sound, well, as you just said, fairly magical. And fairly different ways of working. But you said you were interested in commenting or discussing on how Datacle can and I guess will help with future trends. So what do you see as future trends for databases and database deployments and I guess the role of databases? What are your trends that you foresee?
Well, I mean, we certainly see a breakdown of silos based on personal experience. You know, this idea that like, oh, I'm a Java developer, and so I can't do anything with the database, or I'm a DBA, so I can't do anything with the containers or whatever. We are moving to gifted generalists. Yep. That know how to code. They understand, you know, memory management and Linux. They understand containers. Yeah. It is full stack developers. And so some are stronger in areas, in specific areas. Others, you know, are weaker. And that's what makes a great team, right? You get people with different backgrounds. And so what we see is these DBAs that previously lived in infrastructure and operations, we see that expertise starting to diffuse out to the product teams, not development teams. They're moving to product teams that, you know, you build it, you run it. But they need database expertise over there. They can't just farm this stuff out. So we need to bring this knowledge that frankly has been trapped on the other side of a ticket system and bring it into our product teams so that our companies can write the best software. We can't treat data as this thing that is high on the hill, the shiny beacon that only highly skilled trained people can mess with. We used to think that way about websites, and we had webmasters. You know, and when's the last time you're at a cocktail party and somebody introduced themselves as, oh, I'm a webmaster?
I actually used to do that as a job. So yeah. It has been a long time since I've mentioned that.
And also Buildmaster. Yeah. So we're still going to have database administrators, but these are going to be folks that really understand the ins and outs of block storage and how Oracle works, how MySQL works, those sorts of things. But we don't need someone to review that's external to the development team. We should have that code review process for our Java code, our SQL code, any type of code as part of a peer review process in the product team, in that development team. And so that's where I see this goes. We're going to have, right now we have system DBAs and application DBAs. They both live in I&O land. And companies that work with Datacle are starting to shift those resources, those people over to development land, the ones that want to. The ones that want to stay in I&O land, there's certainly a place for them and it's growing, but it's no longer to handle help desk.
And I guess this feeds into that microservices type infrastructure as well, where in theory, you know, what you use to accomplish an application task will shift and change and is somewhat irrelevant. Allowing this decoupling of systems, but also roles, facilitates that even more. And if you have people who feel like they're just set in, I just do this thing, then it doesn't allow for those constant shifts and changes. Yeah.
Yeah. We need to quit treating software like we're building a physical thing.
Yeah.
We need to get away from this assembly line idea that there is a line that goes from left to right. And we need to start viewing this as an organism that much like, you know, any organism, there are cells that are constantly replenished. Mm-hmm. Some faster than others, but the human body doesn't just shut down like, oh, well, I need to make some more red blood cells. We're going to go into maintenance mode for, you know, 2 hours. You can't do anything. We need to start looking at our systems like that, the software that we deliver. And, for too long, we've looked at it in this linear, we had a very linear approach. We got to go from left to right, step at, you know, and that doesn't work. We need to be able to update one bit of the system and not impact the other folks. And that's why microservices, that's why we've seen this explosion recently with cloud native apps, those sorts of things, because that's what it provides. It provides the ability to change a bit of software, to improve it without having to get the okay from everybody else. And that's very powerful.
And just to reiterate that on that cloud native point, I'm guessing Datacle also doesn't have any issues with integrating with cloud native databases. And I'm having a complete blank for a second on the Amazon one.
Or Dynamo.
Mm-hmm. Google Cloud has one as well. I'm sure Azure has one. You know, I'm guessing that Datacle also integrates quite well with those, and in fact, possibly even better, because you kind of get a sort of end-to-end smoothish chain of transition without having to wait for new deployments and things like that. They'll kind of get deployed in succession.
Sure. Well, we are rolling out our support for document stores Mongo and Dynamo at the beginning of next year.
Okay, well, that's good, because that's something I just sort of was skirting around an assumption without ever actually asking. So it's a good job that it came up.
absolutely. But as far as Aurora goes and MySQL compliant databases or MySQL variants like Maria, those sorts of things, that comes out after the middle of the year. But when I say cloud native, I'm really talking about cloud native applications, like 12-factor apps that don't have state, those sorts of things, things that are using Docker containers. But we primarily see companies using things like Pivotal Cloud Foundry to build these. And that's where they're going. We have companies that they have purchased Datacle and they're using it for today's legacy apps. But as they replatform to, say, Pivotal, they're also using Datacle to update that database as well, because there is still a difference between the rate at which I can update my PCF app and I can update my database. And so no matter how fast you move with your Pivotal app, you're still constrained by how slow you are with updating the database. So we need to align those two things.
And actually, I mean, I guess you just recently released your 2018 state of database deployments in DevOps survey. And this reiterates a lot of those similar numbers. And the numbers are scarily high, but probably not surprising to anybody. And things like 90% of enterprise application teams face pressure to release more quickly, but at the same time, equally high percentages say that it often database changes slow them down. Applications, of course, require database changes. And the one that I think I like, or I like in quote marks, the most was the 91% admit to reworking database changes multiple times, which fits very nicely into your preview tool that you wouldn't have to do that. Or you would have to do that, but you wouldn't have to actually make the change before doing that. So instead of, you know, it's like a succession of git fix last commit commits. You
know? Yes, absolutely.
So I would encourage people to have a look through that as well. I think anyone who has been developing for a while and has moved maybe into the more NoSQL world remembers the pains of frequent database changes, and if they're still in that world, then at least knows that they want to do something about it. So, for sure.
But you got to understand that it's also in that NoSQL big data semi-structured space as well, and that's why we're moving into it.
Which I'm actually interested.
Like Cassandra has schema. Cassandra.
Yeah. They definitely do. Yeah. It's a little bit of a misnomer when they say they're schema. They're not schema-less. They're just schema flexible.
it's a different schema. That obviously came from the marketing department at those data store companies.
Yeah, and I have worked for some similar companies before, and yeah, it was always a bit of a. Yeah, misnomer. It's like, oh, you just changed the schema. It won't affect anything. Well, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, it's you know, when they really talk about schemaless, you can certainly say, well, things like Dynamo and Mongo don't have a schema because it's not shared across all the different, each document has its own schema. But if you are going to, let's say you've written code that assumes there is one address per customer, and then somebody in the line of business says, well, we need the ability to have multiple addresses. So instead of one-to-one, it becomes one-to-many. So the way, if you talk to the folks behind those platforms, they will say, oh, well, you just need to make your code backwards compatible. That's a cop-out. And so, you know, the support that you know, what we see people struggling with is they are writing scripts to go through every single one of these documents, these JSON files, and fix them and change them. That is no different than writing a SQL script to go and change your structure. It's just worse because it operates on one at a time. And so there needs to be a better solution there. But just because they say it's schemaless doesn't mean there's no structure.
No, for sure.
And that structure isn't going to change.
Okay, in the final few minutes we have available, any other things, future-looking, forward-looking comments you want to add in about databases or, as you mentioned earlier, comics?
Oh, for sure. I got to tell you, it is really, I'm very happy to see what I'm terming the geeks won. All right. And so when we start talking.
That's a whole other big conversation about whether that has entirely been a good idea on current events. But yes, let's leave that one for now.
Oh, okay. Well, what I was going to say is that
I'll leave my comment there for now. Carry on with your statement, but it's a big conversation, I think.
Oh, for sure. But what I would say is that with things like we have realized that DevOps actually improves. Increases market capitalization. Mm-hmm. Companies that are high IT performers outpace S&P 500. And there was a bet that Warren Buffett made about 10 years ago with a money manager, a hedge fund manager, that the hedge fund manager could beat the S&P 500 over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And he failed. And so he had to donate $1 million to Warren's favorite charity. Mm. Well, what we've seen is that companies that adopt DevOps, that are becoming high IT performers, those companies actually do outperform the S&P 500. So we've actually found a way, and it's the geeks who have found a way to make sure that their company outperforms their peers. And for every C-level exec that is not paying attention to this, they deserve all the bad things that is going to happen to their share price. The ones that buy into this, that let their geeks in their company solve these problems and get out of the way, they will succeed and they will make very nice, get their very nice bonuses out of that.
Yeah. And actually, this is very interesting. I noticed that I was at Mobile Congress earlier in the year, and the mobile world, a lot of the people behind the mobile world are actually fairly old school enterprise companies. And the thing that surprised me most in most of the interviews I did was how companies that I would have never have thought of in a 100 years of talking about things like microservices and containers and decoupled applications and involving developers in decisions were all talking about it. So It's happening very quickly. Which is very interesting. And the fact that not only were they talking about it, but they actually seemed to know what they were talking about was a yes. very encouraging sign. But anyway. Yeah,
they're starting to get it, and it's very exciting to see it. It's finally happening.
Yeah. So I guess seems like a nice point to leave that. Just to wrap up then, what's been your favorite comic of the year so far?
Man, I got to tell you, I think right now Jonathan Hickman's run on East of West is phenomenal.
Yeah, I have read a few of those. Yeah. I'm trying to find the one that I just read over the weekend that really I loved. I tend to be a little bit behind because I buy most of my comics through bundles. But but I read something over the weekend that was a collection from IDW that was really, really cool. I can't remember what it was called.
With next, I don't know when this is going to go live, but, you know, we've got Avengers coming out this weekend.
Yeah, and I'm going to go and watch that tomorrow. So,
Well, that's Jonathan Hickman. He wrote, kind of the bones of that story is from his Avengers run. Which I highly recommend anybody reading. It is just phenomenal. It is so good.
I am Sean Suchter. I am the co-founder and CTO of Pepperdata. We are a total performance management company for big data applications and clusters. So by that, we mean that we have a suite of products that provide both a APM application performance management solution and OPM operations performance management. And our products, since we have data for both of these things, we kind of seamlessly go back and forth between, APM and OPM, which is really high utility in these big data systems, especially because they're frequently DevOps. And so the constituent cares about both development and operational concerns. So that's what we do.
Okay, and we're going to have a little talk specifically about Kubernetes, and I can actually see you've got a webinar coming up very soon on the 2nd of May called Building a Big Stack on Kubernetes. Mm-hmm. I'm actually interested, Kubernetes has a lot of managed hosting options, of course, but a lot of people will also set it up themselves. So are you using Kubernetes behind the scenes at Pepperdata, or is this kind of about how to build a stack that incorporates Pepperdata as some sort of external service?
I guess the answer is yes to both. So we are using Kubernetes internally. Mm-hmm. However, the talk is more about how somebody else might use Kubernetes to do big data work. Mm-hmm. As an alternative to the traditional big data stack.
Okay.
So it's a very...
Does that complement or compete with what Pepperdata does in some respects?
It's kind of orthogonal because, our thought is that, and the reason we got involved in Kubernetes is because we were thinking about, hey, we have a product in this big data on Hadoop space, this this TPM product. But that might not be the only game in town in the future, right? People might have other ways that they want to do big data. other infrastructures that they use. And so we started thinking about it and said, well, Kubernetes is going to be an infrastructure kind of for everything. So what about, you know, but it doesn't yet really get used for big data. This is a couple of years ago that we were thinking about this. And so that led us down the path of, well, if you wanted to just do big data and start from scratch and not have all of the existing infrastructure necessarily, not the standard way of doing it, how would you go about doing that? And so that led us into the thought, well, you'd pick a very modern, you know, infrastructure orchestration fabric, right? And, okay, that's Kubernetes. You'd pick the most modern compute engine, that's Spark. You would have to have a storage system, right? Hey, there isn't really anything better than HDFS. So that part, let's just take from Hadoop. That's really good. And, you know, this was not just our vision. There were other, you know, entities involved as well. And so we were part of the group that worked towards making big data work, you know, in a full-fledged, full-power big data stack on Kubernetes. Now, from a Peppery, the company perspective, it seems very likely that people will, at some point, want to have OPM solutions for their big data stacks running on Kubernetes. So I expect, at some point, we might offer those. But we don't yet, because we're still just making sure that running big data on Kubernetes is a super viable thing. And we're right now, we're still focusing a little more on that.
So you've mentioned a few projects that are quite common in the big data space, Hadoop and HFS, Spark. When you set up this webinar, this idea to bring people who might need something like this into this world, are they coming from worlds where they're using some of those tools already, or are they starting from a step even before that?
I've spoken with people who are both, who, you know, I think probably it's more heavily biased towards the ones who are already using some big data tooling, who are at least familiar. I think the other interesting question there is something that you were alluding to a second ago. Are they doing it using a managed service, or are they doing it on premise, right behind a firewall? And
yeah, I think that's one thing. Or they might just be using a completely different tool set or Excel spreadsheets.
Right, right. It's well, so the ones who are just using Excel spreadsheets, if it really works in Excel spreadsheets, I guess you're okay. But I mean, that scales out pretty quick.
Yeah, for sure.
If you're using a managed service, right? If you're using AWS or any number of things, you probably have big data processing tools that they'll offer you, and you would have to have a specific reason to want to not use those. And there are good reasons where you might want to just stand up a Kubernetes cluster and then intermix everything in that. But the case where it really makes a slam dunk is when you're building infrastructure behind a firewall, right? Or on-premise or something like that, where you're not going to mash together a bunch of different cloud tools and get the kind of lock-in that that cloud provider gives you, things like that. If you're going to make your own, you know, private system, that's where this Kubernetes solution really shines, both from an efficiency perspective, but also from a DevOps perspective. It's a very good solution because you basically can say, yeah, I'm just going to take all my resources and throw Kubernetes at them, right? And so now, you know, they're just all in one big, you know, Kubernetes cluster, and I can do everything with it. You want me to, you know, do my microservices or my, you know, not so microservices? Sure, we can do that. You want me to do my, you know, large scale, long-term durable storage? Sure, we can do that. You want me to do my, you know, SQL processing and my, you know, streaming and my ad hoc analytics? Sure, we can do that too. And so it's the first time that you can actually, as a DevOps organization, or just, you know, or a separate dev and ops organization, you can just have one infrastructure that allows you to do it all really well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, historically, there's been a lot of compromise where you had to, you know, do various things very poorly. And in this case, you don't really have those compromises because, I mean, as evidence, we're talking basically the best of breed tools for doing big data stuff. Mm. Yeah, they just work fine just natively on Kubernetes. So you can clearly see that it's not a strong compromise situation.
And actually, just to check there, because it's I've written and dabbled around this area, but mostly, I guess, with I just wrote something recently on hybrid clouds, which tends to be a mixture of all sorts of various sources of information. So I'm guessing there is no real problem distributing your Kubernetes cluster behind or parts of it behind and in front of corporate firewalls, as long as you set everything up correctly.
There is no problem with that, and there's actually stuff to help with that even.
Okay, yeah. There's, what's it called?
Federation?
Yeah, KubeFed or something like that, wasn't it? Yeah. It was weird because I was looking into a whole bunch of tools around that space, and a lot of them a little bit more user friendly. KubeFed is very powerful, but out the box is somewhat hard to get going with. But I guess that provides lots of opportunities for third party providers to.
Yeah,
make
I mean, I think Kubernetes Federation is new-ish compared to the rest of Kubernetes. Yeah. I think that as more people wrap their brains around it, it will probably have the, you know, polish that you know, the rest of the stack is getting.
For sure.
But it's from a technical perspective, it's a very powerful underpinning.
Yeah.
So it's the right base to build on.
So why would someone working with big data need an orchestrator like Kubernetes? What's wrong with just having a bunch of instances kind of chugging away when you need them, and that's generally fine? Like, why would I need to add in something like an orchestrator into my big data stack? Why is it useful to me?
Well, you already have some, you probably already have some kind of orchestrator, right? Because the traditional way to do big data is Yarn.
I'm asking a slightly facetious question.
Yeah, so the, you know, the point is you probably already have something. You have Yarn, right? And if your sole job and goal is to do big data, right, then the advantages of something more general like Kubernetes are limited. They're there, right? Like for long-running services, Kubernetes is really great at that. Yarn is just emerging on that. So if you know, if you're running a bunch of Zeppelin notebooks alongside your back end, you know, that's a little more convenient to do with something like Kubernetes, but that's not a major advantage. I think the major advantage is when you're not just doing big data. And this is super important in as the organizations grow and get more complex, because there's this big disconnect between the parts of an organization who have the capability of doing services and the parts of the organization that have a capability of doing big data. I don't think, did we ever talk about the big data island analogy? I don't think we did, right?
I can't remember, but I guess it's okay. Somewhat similar to silos in some respects, maybe.
No. So here's my analogy on this. And I think it's, so if you look at the way, you know, I was around for the origin of like the Hadoop stack, right? I was at Yahoo and I was the first user, you know, period. And it was the group two floors down from me who was working on building the software. So, you know, and the interesting, you know, and we had the scale problem. So we had to basically, you know, and all the data warehouses kept trying to pitch us to, you know, hey, we'll process your data. And like none of them could even come close to our scale. The same thing happened at Google, but they have their own tool set.
For sure.
But so we had to invent this tool set, Hadoop, and it basically is a custom stack of software that you run on a separate, you know, set of hardware that's bought, you know, specially for this purpose, and they've got their own networking setup, and there's like this entire ecosystem from the metal on up, is this completely bespoke way of doing things, bespoke in the sense that it's specifically for big data. And meanwhile, while this is all getting developed, on the other hand, you know, if you look at the people who are doing the actual services, right, there's been all this innovation, right? There's all this innovation in storage and in VMs and in management methodologies that's gone on for the rest of IT. So I kind of say that big data is this, you know, island, and the rest of IT is the continent, right? And most of any given organization is the rest of IT. And then there's this little part of the organization that is using the specialized big data systems. They've got separate administrators. Sometimes they've got separate developers. So it's a completely organizationally separate thing between the mainland and this big data island. And for the last, you know, over a decade, they have been completely separated, where never the twain shall meet. And that's very, very limiting, because if you imagine somebody on the mainland wanting to, you know, oh, I've got just this one little data thing that I need to do, or I want to integrate with the data thing, now it becomes a cross-organization, cross-functional effort that is very organizationally hard to do. And if you compare this to, say, you know, one example is if you look at what goes on in the internals of Google, they don't have that kind of separation, right? Anybody who, you know, like, their tools are all completely integrated. There is no mainland and island that are so separate. And so, you know, it's much more effective for their organization to do things that, you know, can cross this boundary. That has not been accessible to the rest of the, you know, enterprise world until the advent of, like, this, hey, let's talk about doing, you know, integrating big data and non-big data in the same thing. So now, you know, if you want to run a big data stack on Kubernetes, you're going to be running it on the same hardware. You're going to have the same operators. Yeah. You're going to have the same developers. So that is, it's not a little thing, actually. It's a really, really organizationally empowering thing.
At least you may not be able to bring down the team style divisions at first, but by everyone using in quote marks the same infrastructure, although of course one of the points of something like Kubernetes is the infrastructure is somewhat fluid, it means that at least you have access to the same resources much easier should you want them.
And it's entirely reasonable as a developer, if I want to make an application that, you know, blurs, you know, has a part of my application that's doing some service and a part of my application that's, you know, capturing some data and a part of it that's processing some data and doing some machine learning and then going back to some service, I can cohesively make that application. Like one developer or one developer team or whatever can make that whole application, you know, because now the infrastructure abstraction is all shared. Versus before, like, that would be a huge cross-cutting organizational endeavor. So that affects the fundamental way that organizations can do engineering, and I think that's the really big deal here.
And I mean, when it comes to big data especially, it's very hard to give recommendations on numbers of instances or the configuration of those instances, because especially when you're processing and analyzing data, it's very, very application specific. But what would be what would be some at least common tips or gotchas that you would recommend to people who would like to maybe move into using Kubernetes for their big data stack?
Well, I mean, the right question is just how much. The first question is just how much RAM and storage do you need, right? So figure out the total RAM that you need. And I would definitely suggest that the way people should think about it is figure out the total RAM you need, right? Don't worry about how it's divided between nodes. Just how much total do you need? And, you know, then, you know, you can decide, you know, hey, do I, you know, if I need 100 gigs, do I get, you know, do I get four machines at 25 gigs? I mean, I know there'll be powers of two. I'm just making it easier for us humans. You know, do I get four machines at 25 gigs or 10 machines at 10 gigs? It doesn't really matter all that much, right? If it's all the same, get a slightly larger machine, I guess, because you'll have less machines to manage. But that's a pretty minor point, especially if, you know, you're using a cloud infrastructure, you don't really care. The, you know, the machines will just exist. So I would definitely encourage everybody to work in totals. And a lot of people aren't used to doing that. They're I need this many nodes of this classification. And total RAM is super important. Total storage is kind of important, right? You need to have more than you need for sure. CPU is a pretty compressible resource. So you could use more or less of that depending on how fast or slow you care about things going. And the nice thing about Kubernetes, of course, is that it'll do a really good job of, you know, scaling up and scaling down your usage of things like CPU. So that's a pretty flexible thing for you. You don't have to get that exactly right. The way that you had to before.
And because I had some experience with before Kubernetes with Apache Mesos, and that had this concept of letting you kind of program against your entire data centers as one and not have to think about individual memory or CPU at each instance. And does Kubernetes let you do something similar, or is it slightly different?
Extremely similar.
Yeah, okay.
Two peas in a pod there.
So I guess this is a big topic in itself, and there's many, many resources out there on setting up Kubernetes clusters, and it's a very popular subject right now. But just coming back to Pepperdata for a minute, I can't remember exactly when we last spoke, a few months ago at least. What have you been up to as a company recently, and what's on the roadmap for the next few months?
Well, our we've had so much traction on our increasing our APM footprint. So we've been working on, you know, we started the company with an OPM footprint. And a couple of years ago, we introduced our first suite of APM tools. And that's gone incredibly well for us in the market. We've had so much adoption and increased demand for our APM tool chain that we're going to be, you know, pouring more fuel on that fire. So we're doing a lot of things with going very deeply into Spark applications, Hive applications, SQL-based applications to provide very clear, you know, recommendations to say, you know, hey, your application isn't working right in this way. Do this specific thing to make it work better, right? This error happened. This is why that obscure exception happened. This is the root cause. Fix this. So that kind of thing is a big focus for us in the next several months. That's kind of, you know, not really Kubernetes or not specific. That's just, you know, at a high level, that's where the main focus is, because we just had so much success with our current offering. And it makes us, you know, feel like, hey, well, let's do more of that. In the Kubernetes front specifically, I could also mention, you know, I'm really excited that we've got, you know, like a bunch of really robust features. You know, the Spark Kubernetes support has just been incorporated into the upstream Spark engine. So the latest Spark release 2.3 is. Of, you know, Kubernetes native support was one of the highlighted features. HDFS, we've, you know, gotten full Kerberos support and full HA support. And I expect we'll probably have an alpha release of the native HDFS on Kubernetes soon. So those are both pretty exciting things.
So definitely making sure you can be part of that Kubernetes future when you're ready. And just one final question. In this space generally, I mean, obviously, Kubernetes orchestration, a whole bunch of other buzzwords, cloud native, microservices, et cetera, the kind of current trend in big data processing especially. But do you see anything coming down the line in the next year or so that's the next trends that you think people should be aware of?
Well, so there's something interesting that's the pieces are coming together, but I don't think I've seen a lot of, you know, full realizations of all the separate pieces as they come together. So I talked about Spark and HDFS, right? Those are interesting pieces, but there's also native Kubernetes support for Airflow now. So Airflow is a very popular workflow scheduler that allows you to do very complex enterprise workflows, and that can work, you know, use Kubernetes natively as its, you know, orchestration environment. Also, machine learning and TensorFlow are, of course, work very well on Kubernetes. And if you put all of these things together, right, you suddenly get the ability to describe, you know, completely programmatically, so you can actually make an application that does, you know, big data storage, processing, analytics, machine learning, you know, every buzzword you want, right? And the microservices, you can actually describe and make a complete application programmatically. And so there's two things that I think that's going to make interesting. One, organizations for themselves writing their applications that way, instead of thinking of them as piecemeal things, think of them as the entire app. That's kind of interesting. The other thing that I think will emerge, I don't know when, but I think it will, is companies making packaged products that are like this, right? Here's the entire, you know, suite. Just give me a Kubernetes cluster, and it wraps all these things together and does some application that uses all these buzzwords. And suddenly, instead of the attempt to install those applications being an army of consultants and a super complex, heavyweight thing, it's just like, oh, yeah, tell me where the Kubernetes API server is, you're done. Right? And it's like, it's an app store ease for enterprise complex apps.
Yeah.
That's a game changer.
And I like the idea of being able to describe everything as code. You know, infrastructure as code, et cetera, the ability to version control and track changes between just about everything is a powerful ability to have as well.
So I definitely think that, I think that'll be a real thing. We'll and the, you know, everything as code, you know, source controlled things, you know, the entire thing, and much less tribal wisdom and organizational, you know, state. I think that'll be a real thing we see. So that's kind of exciting.
And that was my two interviews with Robert Reeves of Datacore and Sean Zuchter of Pepperdata. If you enjoyed the show, you can find previous episodes at gregariousmammal.com/podcast, and you can support the show at gregariousmammal.com/support. Also find us on Facebook, look for Gregarious Mammal, and you can find me on Twitter @ Chris Chinch. Talk to you next time.